Good evening, everyone. My name is Josh Beiser, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. Tonight, my guest is the founder of Serenity Forge. Please welcome to the cast, Z, and I'll let him give you his full name.
Hey, how's it going, Josh? This is Z. I guess my full name is Jinghua, but that's a little hard to talk about, so usually people just call me Z.
That's okay. Yeah, Z, it's great to have you on, and I've already spoken to several developers in the international market, so I've had to say some pretty hard-to-pronounce names in the past.
Yeah, because earlier you tried to pronounce my name a little bit. I actually sounded really close. I was very, very impressed.
Yeah, maybe doing all these podcasts, maybe it's helping my tongue motor skills grow in.
Yeah, maybe.
So, I know you were just getting started with your introductions, and I think that will be a great place to start. So, for people listening who don't know who Serenity Forge is or UZ, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your studio?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Z. I was born in China. Came to the United States when I was around 10 years old. And I started Serenity Forge a few years back in 2008. And it's since then, we've been making a lot of different video games. The reason for our foundation was actually because when I was 18 years old, when I was in college, my first year of college, I had this near fatal illness that made me drop out of school for 2 years, and then I had to be hospitalized. And it really gave me a different view, a different look on life, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And since then, I realized that, hey, you know, maybe I should do something more more meaningful, more passion-driven, instead of just going on the same path of, you know, an engineer or a finance guy or something like that. So that's when I started Serenity Forge, and we're a team of 10 people right now located in Boulder, Colorado. Our goal is to make meaningful games, artistic games that kind of challenge the way that people think about their lives, our society, and everything like that. We just feel like the video game medium, there's so much potential in the medium, and it's still so much in its infancy that we want to push it forward. In a metaphorical sense.
Yeah. And it's great to talk about that passion, Z, for getting into the game industry. I know you really need to have that, I think, to make great games and just to be in this industry, because it really is an industry of enthusiasts and people who want to be here. As we've talked about on previous podcasts, it can be very challenging to get your foot in the door, to be able to become a game developer or even get into a studio. I know I've had nothing but trouble. I mean, we could sit here and talk for like 2 hours on about the challenges of breaking in. It's that in depth. But yeah, the passion is definitely there. I mean, it's one of the things I love about game design and talking to developers like yourselves is being able to have these great discussions about a variety of topics, and you really hear that passion in the people. I mean, it's not like you're going to have someone come into these casts and it's like, oh, I make games for a living.
Right, yeah.
No, I mean, we've had discussions. I was telling Z before the cast. I mean, when I talk to people like John Schaefer, Chris Park, I mean, we can have like 2-3 hour discussions. The only things that stop us are usually like family or someone has to go eat at some point.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I definitely understand that. I remember when I was in high school, I reached out to every single game developer in the state of Colorado to try to see if I can get some kind of an internship experience or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the industry is tiny. It's hard to get into, especially when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. And the best I could do is, you know, start my own team, and here we are.
Yeah. That's definitely the story that we hear from a lot of indie developers these days, especially some of the ones I've spoken to, like Alex from Robot Loves Kitty, some of the people from, like, Rage Squid, and even stuff from, like, overseas, like Beta Dwarf. These are developers who want to get in the industry, and either there weren't studios hiring around, or there weren't studios, period, and they just said, you know, let's just make our own studio. And right. Lo and behold, they were able to do that. And it is quite amazing these days that it's gone a lot easier for new developers to really start up, thanks to improved game development tools, Steam, and just really the indie movement has really taken off since like 2009, maybe 2010, I think, in terms of allowing someone to put out their own game. And it's just really amazing to see how far we've come in the last, I guess, maybe 20 years, maybe a little bit more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you recently, I think at GDC, they announced that pretty much every single game engine out there is mm-hmm. free now for everyone to use. Unity 5 just got released. You got Unreal and then the CryEngine or Source. that's free too for people to use. And these things were all exclusive 10 years ago. These things are all really hard to get into 10 years ago. It's really phenomenal to see where the industry is going.
Definitely. And again, that's another one of those 2-3 hour topics we could easily talk about with looking at the future. To get things back to you and your studio, Z, I saw on your list, so your first game, Loving Life, that was, of course, a visual novel type game. And you, of course, mentioned a few minutes ago that it was based on your near-fail or near-death experience back in college. Besides the visual novel genre, what other types of games or genres do you like to create, or even those you just like to play in your spare time?
Yeah, Serenity Forge works on a lot of different types of games. In fact, all of our games kind of come from a different genre. Loving Life, like we talked about earlier, is a visual novel, non-fictional visual novel about my own experiences. And then a few weeks from now, April 23rd, is when we'll be releasing Luna's Wandering Stars on Steam. And that game is a planetary physics puzzle game. So the game kind of has 100% real physics in the game while you're kind of playing an addictive puzzle. So that's a completely different genre in itself. And then we are working on two other games currently, one called Pixel Galaxy, which is a really kind of an old school arcade shooter type of game. Mm-hmm. However, the trick is that the player doesn't actually get to shoot in the game. Instead, the player has to touch all the enemies and turn them into their friends and try to survive together. And then lastly, the final game that we're still making right now is it's called The King's Bird. And this game is probably going to be released way later, maybe mid-2016. And this game is a precision platformer game inspired a lot by Journey and Dust Force. We wanted to kind of bring beauty and elegance into a precision platformer game inspired by, freedom and flight and flow.
Cool. Now, are you working on these different titles at the same time, or are you just working on them in order?
That's the funny thing. A lot of people say that game developers should never work on multiple titles at the same time, especially when you're indie. Mm-hmm. And I can definitely understand what that means, because it is hard to work on multiple things at the same time, mm-hmm. not being able to release titles on time, missing deadlines and all that. However, for us, it's actually been working out pretty well. We are currently working on 4 titles at the same time, 3 titles here in-house, and one more kind of contract work for other people. And it's been working out great for us, and we really do enjoy it. It's like one day you can work on one game, and then the next day you can work on something else, and really shift your mindset, mm-hmm. and it kind of keeps you motivated. It really keeps you energized at work. Mm-hmm.
And that's a very interesting point, Z, because as you said, when we speak to a lot of developers, we hear quite the opposite, that a lot of people want you to just focus on one game, put your head down, focus on for the next 6 to 8 months, get it done, and then, shift gears to another one. So it's interesting how a multiple game model is working for you and the rest of your team at Serenity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people kind of have that mindset where it's like, I'm going to work on one game, I'm going to release it, then it's done, then I get to move on to the next thing. The truth is, in life, nothing really happens like that. I mean, mm-hmm. you make a game, right? And you work on it really hard, you release the game, but that's almost only half the battle, right? Mm-hmm. You got to sell the game, you got to do marketing, you got to track the statistics, and you got to see what you can learn from it. It's almost like scientific theory in a lot of ways, where it's you got to do a hypothesis testing whether or not this game is going to do well in the market. And then you track your data to make sure that your hypothesis checks out, or maybe it needs additional tweaking. And then you do the same thing for your next game. And over time, that's how you learn. That's how you grow as a company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like your approach of being able to basically switch gears each day so everything keeps fresh to you. Because as I think about and the work that I do with Game Wisdom, I'm sort of becoming more in that mindset myself. Like, I can't sit and do one thing for like 5-6 hours at a time. I like to switch gears a lot. It's even factor into how I play video games these days. I don't remember the last time I sat for like a good 4 or 5 hours and played one game. I usually play a game for like an hour, switch to something else, switch to another thing, and then maybe I'll go back to the game for like 30 minutes later on. But I'm just constantly keeping things rotating. Keeping things fresh for me.
Right. I mean, especially for modern day society with all the crazy stuff going on around us, there's movies you can watch, you can go outside, you can look at your phone, you can check Twitter, you can check Tumblr, you can check everything. And when people are kind of trained to do that, it's hard to get out of it. Mm-hmm. Staying focused is one of the hardest things for kids in school nowadays.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad thing. It's not a wrong thing. It's just, this is how we are now. This is how we live life now. Mm-hmm. And it's important to kind of know that too, for the workplace. For example, artists, especially, they're creative people, right? You know,
yeah.
Designers, artists, writers, they're creative people. You can't just let them sit there 8 hours a day and be like, draw this one thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to work out and it's going to feel terrible. And the same thing goes for all these, like, for example, business people, accountants, financial specialists.
Mm-hmm.
These people are feeling like their lives are very difficult right now because there's so many more things you can do in life. That's why everyone wants to go make video games, right?
Yeah. And very interesting that you said that about, like, the normal 9-to-5 job. I mean, I did that back, like, in 2009 when I worked at Comcast for 2 years.
Oh, wow. What did you do there?
I was a customer support on the phone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if I really do, like, a regular 9-to-5 job anymore. Just because, as you said, Z, how much things have changed with how rarely information is available, how many things we have access to. I mean, hell, I don't watch like one TV show anymore. I'm usually watching something while I'm on the computer, while I have like my phone nearby so I can watch something else. Like, I'm always doing like two or three things at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I came from a finance background myself. I worked at the Federal Reserve for a little bit, and that's what got me into this industry, right? It's having had that experience, you know, how the rest of the world is like, and you're like, you know what, let's go do something a little bit more fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. All right, getting back to your games, I know you just talked about how each one of your games is based on a different genre, a different design. In terms of like your overall design philosophy for the studio, what do you generally like to make? Do you like to work on games that are focused for like a hardcore audience, casual, something in between?
I think this goes back a little bit more to what we talked about earlier,
mm-hmm.
about why we're making games, right? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of audiences you can try to target, a lot of markets you can try to, you know, pinpoint. But ultimately, it's the purpose of the company that really matters at the
mm-hmm.
end of the day. And our purpose, what we want to do is that we want to create value, create meaning, create artistic experiences through the video game medium,
mm-hmm.
whether or not it's a video game even. I mean, if you look at games like Gone Home or Dear Esther, sometimes people argue that they're not video games. They're just quote-unquote pretentious things where you walk around in, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's but we love it. That those are the things that we love. And we want to create emotional experiences like that.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I have another thought when you're done.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, so we try to make games that are, I don't know if this is the right word, but appealing
mm-hmm.
for as many people as possible, but in a value-driven kind of sense, in a way where these people, when they're done playing these games, they can, you know, sit back and think to themselves, okay, well, I experienced something new that I haven't before. This is really great. This is really exciting. This is motivational. Or it could be, oh, wow, this showed me something that I've never seen before. This is sad. This is depressing, but I've learned something from it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the types of games that we wish to make.
Cool. And you had two really good points in that discussion, Z. The first one that I want to talk about is, as you said, with games like Gone Home, Dear Esther, and sort of that debate as to whether or not they can be considered quote-unquote games. This is one of those conversations that we've been hearing more and more about over the last few years. I know with, like, the Stanley Parable is another example.
Yep.
And this is one of those points I find interesting, especially as someone who grew up playing, you know, what's considered the old school these days. I played, you know, NES, Atari, Super Nintendo, and those were the days where games really didn't have a story, or the story was essentially, you know, save the princess, beat the bad guy. I mean, I wrote this on a post a few months ago, but pretty much our most amazing or twist moment was when we found that Samus was a girl in Metroid. That was pretty much our epiphany at that time. And it is kind of weird going from that period today when you have games like Gone Home or Dear Esther, where it's more about the story or the experience over like 2 to 3 hours, as opposed to buying a game that you're going to sit and, you know, challenge yourself over for 10 to 20 hours. And that also raises the point on pricing these types of games. We've been having discussions and looking at the issue of game devaluation over the last year or so. And it's hit the mobile market really hard. We're seeing it slowly in the PC, especially with indie developers who are trying to release like games at like $5 or less. And it's kind of very challenging when you start talking about games that you really can't quantify their elements as well, just like the visual novel genre or story-driven games, and trying to say, you know, is this game worth $14? Is it worth $20, etc.?
Yeah, I definitely agree. If you look at games like The Walking Dead, especially the first season, that game is worth like $80. I'd pay $80 to play that game. But before I bought it, I didn't know how good it was. I think I bought it on a Steam sale for like $4. And I really loved it. And it really motivated me. It's a really good point about how it's hard. The world isn't really built, or at least the video game industry really isn't built right now in the way where you can just look at a game and know what you're getting, right? It's not like you're buying Tide detergent. If you're looking at a box of detergents, then you'll know what you want to get. You want the lemon flavor, not the strawberry flavor, or whatever. I don't even know how you differentiate those. But you get the point. It's for a video game, everything is different. A lot of people say that indie games, they cannibalize each other, or there are substitutes. Like, for example, if you buy Limbo, then you're not going to play Braid anymore. You're not going to play Fez anymore because they cannibalize each other. Or like if you buy Battlefield, you're not going to play Call of Duty anymore. Well, I don't think that's true in a lot of regards. It is true in a lot of other industries. Let's say if you buy a Whopper, you're not going to buy a Big Mac because you're already full, right? But for the game industry, people who play indie games would want to play more indie games, right? It's like if you like Papers, Please, you're probably going to buy this Wormwine and just go try it out. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'll talk when you're finished.
no problem. Yeah, feel free to stop me anytime. I like to ramble on a lot. But that's what I feel when it comes to just the video game industry in general. I think the pricing is very abstract in a lot of ways. A lot of games are priced very highly in order to make it seem like the game is a better game. Because there's no way for players to know whether or not it's good until you get it. So I guess the same kind of issue would plague all creative mediums. But hey, the game industry is the largest one out of all of them right now.
And that is a really good point you made, Z, about the perception that indie games cannibalize other mechanics or genres. When you look at the mobile market, there is definitely an issue of cloning that's going on. And of course, for those of you listening, cloning is when someone essentially directly copies a game, maybe changes up just very slightly, and then tries to pass off as themselves. So we saw stuff like there's the game Angry Birds, and then there's something like Furious Fowl, and then someone try to make something else. And
yeah, like Swimmy Fish.
Yeah, exactly. The whole Flappy Bird craze that took over for like a few days. And that market is definitely showing issues of cloning because people aren't going far enough to essentially differentiate themselves from the other titles. But as you just said, Z, with the indie market, especially with the PC side of things, it's not really cannibalizing each other. Sure, different people may make a 2D platformer or an exploration game, but it's what they do within that space that is entirely different and unique. You brought up like the differences between Limbo versus Braid. And that's a great point there. They're both considered 2D adventure/puzzle platformers, but the designs are just completely different.
Right.
Therein lies that value or that differentiating factor that makes you want to play those different games. And we are seeing some issues with the AAA market, especially with the first-person shooter, the military craze that's going on. That has become a little bit homogenized lately. And that could be where we are seeing some issues, at least on that end of the spectrum. But there's still definitely a market for these unique original games. And again, the indie space has just been amazing for the sheer variety. And I think has really been paramount in really changing the pricing scheme for a lot of video games.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. When it comes to, going back to the cloning topic, I think the ultimate goal here is that the game has to be a good game. Like, you can clone whatever you want. There is no copyright issues about cloning. I don't think there's much ethical rights to anything, even when it comes to cloning things. But you just have to be good at it. I think a really good example is Shovel Knight. Shovel Knight is a very obvious clone of old school Mega Man or Castlevania games, stuff like that, right? It's very apparent that's a quote unquote clone. I know it sounds bad when you say it, but the truth is, it's better than any Castlevania game or any Mega Man game that's ever been made. At least in my opinion, I played a lot of those games as a kid, and playing Shovel Knight, it just felt like they got everything down to it's a science how they built that game.
Yeah, and I did a recent video series on Shovel Knight, just complete spoiler run through the game, and I talked about how the different design elements worked in that game. And you're right, Z, when you look at it from the outside, yes, it's really a clone of 2D games. I mean, it's supposed to look like a game that came out, you know, on the NES back in 1989, 1990. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But when you dig deep into that game, you can see all the little homages and touches they did to make the game their own. So that while, yes, you can say, this section reminds me of Castlevania, or this boss is like Mega Man, but the package as a whole is essentially Shovel Knight.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a really good game, and people pay money for it, and they deserve every cent that they get for making something like that. And on the other end of the spectrum, you see a lot of very creative ideas. Well, you know, there are some are very good. For example, Papers, Please, that was phenomenal. That was ridiculously good. I mean, I guess you can say that it kind of took the spirits of Cart Life a little bit. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's a very good game. Mm-hmm. And it's very creative. And then I don't remember the name of the game, but before Portal was a thing, mm-hmm. there was a game that has the same exact mechanics as Portal. But it was made in a much lower quality. I think it was made by two students mm-hmm. at a university. You know, that. I mean, that game is a great idea. It's the idea that ended up becoming Portal, but it wasn't executed right, and they didn't make the game very well. And so no one's ever heard of it, and you know, people don't care about it as much.
Mm-hmm. And another part of making a successful game, especially today, is what we could essentially call the wrapper, or the aesthetics and the design. Because that's something that I think is becoming more and more important, especially for the indie space, where you have developers trying to make their games stand out among all the other developers. And that's another thing that's sort of been both a blessing and a curse, is that, as we said a few minutes ago, it's become a lot easier for someone to say, hey, I want to start a game studio, I want to make a game. But on the opposite end of that, I mean, when you look at the Steam list or the iOS store releases, we're seeing dozens of games being released almost daily, and probably easily close to like 100 games being released weekly.
Yep.
And it's such a far cry from, again, back in the late 80s, 90s, where you would get one game a month if you were lucky.
Right.
And it's become a lot harder to say, you know, why should someone buy your game when there's 20 other games being released? Now, I know you just said, Z, about how because of the unique qualifiers, it's not the same thing as, I think you brought the example of the difference between like a Big Mac and a Whopper, and how those things are basically a hard choice. You're not going to buy a Whopper and then say, oh, you know, that was good, but, you know, a Big Mac is also good as well. Let me eat that too. There's just no room for it.
Yeah.
But with the video game market, it's a lot different. As we said, someone can play Limbo, they can play Braid, they can play any other game, and the value's still there. The only limitation, really, is in the consumer's wallet.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you can say that, but ultimately, when it comes down to it, from your perspective, mm-hmm. if there was 10 Shovel Knight games, would you buy all 10 of them? I mean, the chances are probably, actually, mm-hmm. right? Because they're good games.
Yeah.
I think a lot of game developers, especially, the game development industry is so passion-driven to mm-hmm. the point where I think a lot of developers are blinded by passion. Mm-hmm. To the point, I mean, I know this is terrible to listen to because mm-hmm. people are like, oh no, blinded by passion, that's, you know, you're a heretic. Mm-hmm. But it's true that people don't realize that what consumers really want. Let's talk about Mega Man clones for just a second. I mean, mm-hmm. you can go on Steam right now, you can go to Greenlight, and every, you know, three games, you'll come across one Mega Man clone of some kind,
yeah.
right? Why are those games not as popular as Shovel Knight? Why is Shovel Knight so much better? And people pay money for Shovel Knight, and they are willing to pay more money for more Shovel Knight if it existed. The problem is it doesn't exist, and developers don't realize that their game is not what consumers really want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like staying with the Shovel Knight example, that is a great game that also made use of crowdfunding, not only to get the budget they need, but to spread the public awareness. And that is a huge factor in terms of getting your game out there. When I've spoken to previous developers, one of the things that I keep hearing is just how important good PR is, how important it is to make sure that you're online every day, you know, maybe posting something to Twitter, making sure people know who you are and aware of what you're doing. As you just said, Z, a lot of developers we can say they are blind by passion. And it's great to have that passion, but at the same time, I think one thing a lot of people need to realize, especially any students or enthusiasts listening, is that part of the video game industry is the business side. And you really do need to understand that in order to be able to make a living out of it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of it is also got to think about how you want to measure your success when mm-hmm. it comes to video game development. Mm-hmm. A lot of people measure it by money. And a lot of people measure it by whether or not they're doing the right thing or doing what they're passionate about. It's important to not get the two confused. I think a lot of times, especially in the early days of Serenity Forge, we had issues thinking about what are just some of our goals as a team. And ultimately, it came down to we're here for the long haul. You know, we want to do good in the long run. Mm-hmm. So that's when we really cleared our heads a little bit and thought about maybe the immediate cash flow into our company isn't as important as maybe the spirit that we're sending out to the world, because mm-hmm. you know that's what we really want to do here. And ultimately, as we grow, as we spread that more, we're going to be able to have more power to kind of spread more of that changing people's lives and doing all the things that we want to do. So I think a lot of developers, when they look at their games, they at first feel like, oh wow, I'm making such a fun game, I would play the hell out of this game because I love it so much. And then once they release the game, everyone else is like, oh, this game's whatever, 6 out of 10, 2 or 2, like 5 out of 10. And it's like, oh no, why am I getting such a terrible score? Why am I not getting all the sales that I wanted? Why are people not paying money for my game? When ultimately, when the person first started making this game, well, they made it in order to satisfy their own needs. Mm-hmm. So it's important to not get too confused.
Yeah. And especially, as you said, with the difference between making a game that you want to play versus making a game that's going to sell. And trying to establish your company and the goals is another very tricky element of it. A lot of people who get into the game industry just get into it with the goal of, I want to make games for a living. Yeah. And they don't think beyond, you know, step 2, step 3, and etc. And that's probably one of the big killers of a lot of indie studios or a lot of indie development, at least on the very small scale, is if you don't think about how this game is going to be perceived by the market or what you're doing to get it out there. We spoke with several developers who talked about the challenge of that. I mean, if you release a game and, you know, it does well for one day and then that's it, how are you going to make back that funding if no one knows about your game after 2 days of release? I believe I spoke with Seth Sivak from Proletariat, and we had this whole discussion about what it is to find this perfect storm of essentially game development or game PR, and the importance of making sure your game is constantly on people's minds, so that when it is released, you're not just getting one day of sales, you're getting, you know, this over the course of months, or maybe even the course of an entire year, people looking at your game and buying it. And that's what is really needed, not just to make a great game, but to really keep your studio afloat for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at games like League of Legends, for example, I mean, Riot Games was an indie studio, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And they were making this MOBA, tiny MOBA game that was a ripoff of Dota. Mm-hmm. And it was nothing original. It was nothing new. And they are a tiny team to start with. And look at them now. They're the most played video game of all time in all of human history. Mm-hmm. What did they do different? I mean, they made the game accessible. Mm-hmm. They made it so that every player is always thinking about the game, and accessible as in it's free to play, anyone can play it. And their company goal, their company vision, their value, their ultimate, you know, destination is that they want to have as many players playing that game as possible, mm-hmm. not even thinking about the money part. They only care about how many people are playing that game. And that was their goal, and they achieved it.
Yeah.
That's why they're the most played game of all time. I mean, they don't make money. I, as far as I know, I don't think Riot Games has ever had a year of solid profit. I think ever since, especially since Tencent bought them, Riot Games had always been losing money to some regard year after year. Mm-hmm. But they're still the most played game of all time. And the reason behind it is because, well, profit isn't their number one goal. It's to user acquisition is their number one goal. Yeah. And that ends up changing everything.
Yeah, and you can see that in a lot of the business decisions they've made over the course course of League of Legends development. They've changed character portraits or character designs if people comment on them. The whole tribunal system for right. player feedback. I mean, that is a huge one. They're the only developer I really have heard of that have actively gone out to say that even if you're a competitive player, if you violate the spirit of the game or the terms of service, we're going to kick you out. We don't care, yep. you know, if you're the one of the top 10 players in League of Legends. If you're going to be like this and you're going to misrepresent our community, you know, see you later. We don't care.
Right. And what I really love about Riot is their professionalism mm-hmm. when it comes to treating players. They treat every player very professionally, and they turn the whole game into a sport, right?
Yeah.
If you ever look at a League of Legends, video when it comes to on the esports side, it's always very professional. People are always wearing suits. The commentators are all very professional about mm-hmm. you know the things that they say, and they treat it very seriously. Whereas the rest of the industry, well, they've never really done that before. They always feel like games are just, you know, immature adults being stupid with each other. Mm. And Riot kind of turned that upside down.
Yeah. And speaking about esports and the like, that actually brings up a good question for you, Z. I just want to get your thoughts on this. And that is, what do you think about the sort of esports spread into what's considered traditional sports? We saw this last year with League of Legends players getting competition visas or passports. And right. there's this whole debate as to, should we consider esports like a sport or as a sporting event, something that we could show on ESPN or, you know, primetime NBC or something like that. Yeah. And there's interesting debates on both sides of it. There's people who feel that it doesn't fall within the definition of a sport. I wrote a post a few weeks ago where I basically said that I do think it could be considered a sport, but the definition of a sport has just changed so much over years.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
what do you think ahead. About that? Oh no, that's okay.
Okay, I mean, if golf is a sport, I feel like League of Legends should be one, right? I mean, I think I heard that League of Legends was on ESPN last year, wasn't it?
Dota, I know, had, I think there the Dota 2 Invitational, I think, was broadcast, at least the championship, on, like, ESPN 2.
Right, the Invitational or TI or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's that was a large one. Had a lot of money involved. League of Legends had been bigger than an NBA ever since 2012, I think, the mm-hmm. venue for the World Championship or the North American LCS. And, the World Championship last year was humongous, and this year is probably going to be even bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an avid fan of a lot of different esports, so I follow very closely.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a reason why it shouldn't be a sport. Korea's had channels dedicated to
yeah.
video games ever since, you know, 10, 15 years ago. They had TV channels for it. The whole concept of the video or games in general, when it was first invented in human history,
mm-hmm.
it was to help people, you know, go through hard times. It was a way of entertainment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what was it. Somewhere in the Western world, somewhere in Europe, there was when the game was invented, and people used it to kind of go through years of famine. Whether or not that's a true story, I think it's still being debated by historians. But ultimately, you know, games really serve a larger purpose. And you can see it through the Colosseum. You can see it through, you know, physical sports as we do today. I mean, football is essentially the same as the, you know, the battles in the Colosseum mm-hmm. 1,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it's just evolving. Esports is just the same as any other sport. You do the same thing. You play by the rules. It's like chess. In a way, and I don't think there's any reason for it not to be considered as one.
Yep, definitely. And as you said, Z, with the Korean market, with StarCraft, that was probably, wow, that was like 10, 15 years ago. I mean, that was even before games were really considered more of a pop culture type feel. That was still when it was still considered a niche market. And we saw just how much StarCraft blew up in the international market. I mean, that game really just transformed Blizzard into a powerhouse overnight. Sort of similar to how Riot Games has grown. As you said, with League of Legends, they weren't aiming for a multi-billion dollar game, you know, something they could retire off of. Mm-hmm. They were aiming to make a very quality title. And that actually brings up another interesting point. As we talked about with indie developers and that mindset, this is also where passion, I think, can be seen as an advantage. Because when you're passionate about a project, you want to see it be the best that it can be. You're not interested in it being, you're not interested in basically making you billions of dollars. And people who try to design games like that, trying to make like the lowest common denominator type title, are finding things don't work that way. And that's something that I spoke with Thorsten Rosser about when he talked about just the failure of the casual game market and how they're aiming more for profit as opposed to making a quality product.
Yeah, I think this goes for pretty much all sides of business.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at things like Facebook, for example, Facebook is humongous, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't humongous 10 years ago. It was growing 10 years ago. But when it first got started, Mark Zuckerberg had the idea of he wanted a world that was more open with one another, where people won't have to keep secrets with each other anymore. That was his goal.
Yeah.
And that's how Facebook got made, right? His goal wasn't everyone pay some money, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Facebook, even until today, investors are confused about whether or not Facebook is going on the right path, just because their monetization policy is always, always just so like on the sidelines compared to the real things that they want to achieve. I guess you can say the same thing for like Microsoft or any other really major company that's out there right now. I mean, Activision first started as a very unique background where they were very passionate about their indie development, Activision.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're gigantic. I mean, the only person in the world that's doing really well because he really wanted to make money is probably Warren Buffett, and that's only because he's really passionate about making money and not spending it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you bring up a really good point about the mobile game market, about how all these large mobile companies are just in here for the money. I think there is some truth to that, and I think there is some. I think a lot of gamers overlook some of the major business decisions that they do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know too much about Zynga, but I do recall a quote where a Zynga executive said that the entire Zynga philosophy is that they want to copy what someone has already done, make it better, and then spend enough marketing budget on it so that it beats out its competition. I think that was like some kind of a thing that an executive said. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's an interesting look at things, right? They're essentially throwing money at something so hard that it gives money back.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can look at mobile developers, like, for example, here in Colorado, there's a really large mobile developer called the Backflip Studios.
Mm-hmm.
They made games like Ninja, Paper Toss, Dragon Veil. And, these games do really well. And if you ever talk to some of these executives, these guys are some of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. The culture just feels completely different from something like Zynga. These guys don't even feel like they're in the game industry. They feel like they're in the industry of improving people's lives by giving them something that they care about, giving them characters that they care about on their phones so that when they're going around to their daily work, they have something that they can be attached with, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you have seemingly the same kind of results at the end of the day, but you have two completely different approaches. So I think a lot of people don't realize some of the hidden layers behind the managerial decisions when it comes to larger mobile developers. But I think there's a lot of untold stories behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And trying to get that company culture, I think, can be very tricky. We've seen over the last year or two just some general poor PR among game industry. I mean, we could sit here and talk about the horrors of Gamergate. There's the Paranormal Activity developer kind of blowout. Fez, I think, is another good example of this.
Yeah.
And it's kind of crazy, again, that you can have very passionate people, but then you can have these situations sort of envelop themselves if you're not too careful.
Absolutely. One of the saddest things, at least for me, from my perspective, is there are so many talented game developers, game designers, artists, programmers here in the industry. And a lot of times it goes back to that they're blinded by their passion, and they don't realize that they could do so much more with their talent. They could do so much more with what they're given and what they have. And you mentioned Fez earlier. I feel like Phil is a great designer. He is a fantastic designer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really sad to see what happened in the end because of, just people not being able to manage you know, what's going on around them, people not being able to see the big picture. And I mean, like a lot of people in the game industry, it's very easy to blame other people here in this industry. It's always someone else's fault. Like if you ever play a game of League of Legends, you'll know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's always someone else's problem that, you know, they can't take care of, and then you have to carry their burdens or something like that. And that goes for everyone. Game developers feel like it's the gamers' fault that they don't enjoy the games. Gamers feel like it's the game developers' fault for making bad games. And then, you know, it just kind of goes on and on. And I think it's important. It's just because the game industry is so still in its infancy. I think as time goes on, people are going to start maturing. People are going to start becoming more and more leader-like here in this industry, and just be a little bit more understanding of what's going on with everyone's lives. Ultimately, yes, it's everybody's fault, but it's no one's fault here in the industry. Whenever something happens, it happens. There's a reason why it happens. You know, there's always something that you can do better to fix your own problems, to fix your own ideals. And it's important for game designers and players to think, you know, in that regard.
Yep, definitely. And the sign of the industry maturing, that's another really interesting point, Z, because we have been seeing it over the last, I would say the last decade, so 2002, 2010, was a real mark of trying to make things both standardized and accessible for a lot of games. This is when we saw a lot of the genres like the first-person shooter genre, platformers, and a lot of developers sort of standardize their approach or their methods and made things a lot easier for new people to get into. When you look at game design from the 90s, a lot of the best games were just super difficult to get into. I'm talking stuff like the Might and Magic games, even stuff like XCOM, which many people consider to be an amazing game, but that is just very inaccessible for a lot of people. And we're seeing this maturity, I think, slowly come. But as you said, we're still not there. It's still going to be quite a while before the industry as a whole, I think, has matured.
Yeah, and another layer on top of that is the rest of the world is also changing. I mean, 10, 20 years ago, you know, besides playing video games, you can maybe watch a TV show. Mm-hmm. You can play a board game maybe, and board games are really complex. So, you know, a game like XCOM, it's fine. You can sit there and you can learn it, and it's better than sitting there trying to read a giant rule book that's from your board game, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe for some people. And nowadays, I remember I picked up Batman Arkham City won the Game of the Year or something like that a couple years back. And I was like, oh, I'll go check out what the fuss is about. So I picked up Batman Arkham Asylum. And I played the game for about 5-10 minutes. I was like, can you stop holding my hand? I was like, oh, yeah, you can press this button to throw the boomerang. Press this button to jump. It was like, I don't. I can figure it out myself. You don't really need to, like, show me all this stuff. And it just kind of shows how the world has changed. People don't even have that patience to sit there and press buttons to figure out what's going on anymore. You have to sit there and tell them exactly what's going on in order for someone to understand it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a different feeling, and I guess the game industry is going to shift. It's going to mature, but at the same time, it'll be affected by what's going on in the rest of the world, of course.
Mm-hmm. And you brought up another good point about the tutorial or how games are a lot more guiding players these days compared to 20 years ago. That's another thing that we're seeing. A lot of interesting discussions about how much hand-holding do you really need to show a player. We've got everything from games like Super Mario Galaxy, or pretty much anything from Nintendo that really, you know, slowly guides a player into learning it. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we've got games like Dark Souls and FTL where, you know, 1 minute in, you could die. I mean, I just did a video recording of FTL where I literally died within 2 minutes of starting the game. I was just sitting there going, well, that's it. And folks, we're done here. See you next time.
Yeah, same goes for Rogue Legacy. I remember the first playthrough, you're like supposed to die within the first couple of seconds.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting about, as I said, how much you really want to essentially guide the player on rails. As you said, with like the Batman series, like the first 20-30 minutes is very hand-holding. They do let you have some control, but it's nowhere near like the same capacity that we saw with a lot of classic games like XCOM, Star Control, and so on, where they basically say, okay, here's your thing, you know, go nuts, you know, we're not going to tell you anything else from this point on.
Yeah, I think, obviously it depends a lot on the player. It depends on the demographic you're trying to target. Everyone learns differently. Everyone has a different learning speed. An 80-year-old grandma is not going to learn, you know, the game as fast as a 12-year-old kid. But Yeah, I mean, I think all I think again, this goes back to making good games essentially. For example, Shovel Knight.
Mm-hmm.
I think Shovel Knight it never had the whole hey, you have to press this button to you know to use this one skill or whatever. I don't know when you're playing the game, you probably noticed that there are just very obvious things that they laid out there, like a science almost,
mm-hmm.
where you have to learn a mechanic before you can get through,
mm-hmm.
and then once you get it. They start forcing you to be better at the mechanic throughout
yeah.
that same level, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think this goes, I remember there was a video done by Eagle Raptor. I'm not sure if you ever watched it. It was on the difference between Mega Man, old school Mega Man games, and Mega Man X.
Mm.
And all it talked about is the tutorial that they did, and that's just how ingenious the design was behind that game, and behind those games. And it's I think that's... It's probably my favorite YouTube video of all time. Like, there's a lot of YouTube videos out there, and that's my favorite one. And I watch it, like, once every month just to refresh myself on some of the amazing game design mechanics and science that Egoraptor kind of laid out there through a really funny video. So, yeah, check it out if you have some if you have time.
Yeah, and that's another really great point. In my video of Shovel Knight, I talk exactly about that. And how the level design essentially teaches the player the mechanics without it stopping and saying, press A to jump or press X to attack.
Yeah.
It basically lays it out organically so that you're learning how the game plays through just the general play of it. And then as you go further and further in, they basically remove the safety net and they start challenging with that mechanic. So
yep.
the first time you jump, it's, you know, there's no threat of failure. But by the end of the game, you're making these crazy jumps over bombless pits while
yep.
things are trying to hit you in midair and so on. It's the same exact thing we saw in Super Meat Boy. I did a video recording of that as well. And you can see how the level design grows and changes. Super Meat Boy as a character doesn't change at all from the first second you load the game.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all the challenges and the margin of error that the designer gives you that changes over the course of the game. So that if you look at the first world versus the final world, it's almost night and day. But the beauty is that the player doesn't change essentially in what they're doing. It's the world around them that sort of organically grows to essentially challenge and alter what it wants the player to do.
Right. Have you ever played Dust Force? That's also
yes.
a great example, yeah.
Yeah, Dust Force is crazy like that. I just wish they had full gamepad support because that game would just kill your hand using the keyboard.
Right. Yeah, I remember they actually said that Gearbox, or what was it? Hitbox. I can't remember their name. But they when they first designed the game, they designed it specifically for the keyboard player. They don't want a controller, people using a controller for the game, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. But hopefully they'll be able to release a sequel or do another one like that and get that functionality in. Because
yeah.
we're seeing a lot, that actually brings up another quick discussion we could have. We're seeing how a lot of elements are becoming more and more standardized among game developers, especially indie development. For example, their Steam integration has become very pivotal for a lot of studios, workshop functionality, achievements, the whole deal. And here's another question for you, Z. As someone who got into the industry over the last few years, what are your thoughts on the whole achievement sort of angle that has been added to a lot of games these days? Because again, growing up, there was no such thing as achievements for playing a game. You play the game, it's done, you shelve it. Today, we have developers having all these achievements, all these means to try to keep you playing a game for a longer period of time.
Yeah, I feel like achievements they're nice. I've never been huge into achievements. You know, once in a while, you would come across a really obscure achievement. I remember I was playing Sequence a few years back, made by Jason Wishnov, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. He's he was just one guy who made that game. And it was such a fun game. At the end of the game, I was so astonished by how great that game was. I had to look through every single achievement that I had and had to get all of it just because I loved the game so much.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I feel like achievements, it doesn't... I don't know. It doesn't, from my perspective, doesn't add a lot to my life. I'm more of an intrinsic values type of guy where, you know, if I had fun doing something, I had fun. I don't have to brag about it all. Well, not that much, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But I do see the act or the idea of having achievements. It's going to grow to be bigger, just in general.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the concept of having achievements is not new, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, having trophies and stuff. That's always been a motivating factor for everyone in life through everything. You know, you win a spelling bee, you get a trophy. That's an achievement, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we're finally kind of implementing this into the video game format. And there's definitely ways for us to go further in that, to further motivate people. Like, for example, if you make a game, educational game, let's say an educational game, and then you're learning through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get achievements for learning something. Well, then essentially you can design a spelling bee game, and then in the game you can win achievements, essentially winning a spelling bee, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then now you're all of a sudden you're motivated to learn, you're motivated to do good with your time. And I think that's important. That's where achievements should be in the future. And right now, you know, we're probably just in the process.
Yeah. And things have been going really well, Z, with the conversation. We've had a lot of great discussions. But I do want to move on because I want to keep you here for the next 3-4 hours, of course.
Yeah, no worries.
So before we move on and talk a little bit more about the industry, one last, I guess, general gameplay-related question for you, then, is, I'm not sure if you mentioned this earlier, but I just want to reiterate. In terms of the games that you like to play, like, personally in your spare time, what type of genres or games do you generally tend to focus on?
I guess this kind of goes back to my personal life when I was much younger, like back in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were both gamers. My dad played old school Prince of Persia games on the MS-DOS. He played, you know, RPG games or RPGs. And my mom was an FPS player, surprisingly. She's able to beat the first level of Doom with her eyes closed.
Nice.
You know, like the first Doom, original Doom. So, you know, having those weird parents, they really understand what the game medium was from the very get-go, from, you know, the old days.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents had this idea where it's they want me to know what video games are. I mean, it's not like parents can prevent kids from playing games nowadays, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially not nerds like me. And so they had this idea where whenever I play a video game, they're always going to be sitting there playing with me or watching, or, you know, just like having a conversation. It's like, oh, how do you feel about this part? It's like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, just like good parenting, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And which I think lacks a lot with video game players. But anyways, So with that said, when I was growing up, my parents always kind of curated the games that I played. They always looked for games that are good and meaningful and something that I can learn from. This is digging back to a really old game. I'm not sure if you ever played this game for the Super Nintendo, but it's a game called Uncharted Waters. Mm-hmm. And this game, I loved this game when I was a kid. I think I was in elementary school when I first played it. And it was basically, it's like, it's an RPG, but it's set in a kind of a semi-fictional, you know, kind of semi-fictional world.
Mm-hmm.
Where Columbus just found the Americas, and the rest of the world is trying to go there and try to explore and stuff like that. And the player plays as a sailor, or, you know, the captain of a ship, and you just go around sailing around the world, exploring, fighting pirates, you know, doing all sorts of different things. And I love that game. First, I learned so much about history. I learned about Columbus. I learned about, you know, all the different struggles among the countries. And then I learned all the geography too. Like, I had to memorize a map. I had to memorize the world map. I had to know exactly how long it takes from, you know, to sail from one city, one port to another port. And just by playing that game, I learned so much that since then, I always looked for games kind of like that. So I guess, unfortunately, there's not a lot of, I play a lot of games because I have to kind of, you know, like it's the industry, right? It's the job. It comes with the job.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to actually playing games, you know, I really like games like that where you can learn a lot about yourself, about the world, about other people. You can, you know, expand your own horizons. You can experience something artistic. You know, I mentioned something like Gone Home, Papers, mm-hmm. Please, some of my favorite games. Games like Fire Emblem, the whole series. I love that series. It taught me so much about strategic decisions, you know, making calculated moves, taking risks, stuff like that. Games like Uncharted Waters and all the other stuff that Koei did back in the days before they got merged with Tecmo.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess these are the games that I really enjoy, truly enjoy playing.
Yeah, and the Koei games back then were a really good example of adding that complex. I remember they did the Romance of the Three Kingdoms games.
Yep.
That was eventually folded into the Dynasty Warriors series.
Which is a little different.
Yeah.
And but, also the Nobunaga's Ambition. I don't know if you heard that. Yep.
I've heard of it. I don't think I've ever played it. But it's kind of interesting, again, going back to that divide between the 90s style design versus the 1000s design. Now, we saw a lot of really complicated games aimed at kids back during the 90s. And now these days, as we talked about a few minutes ago, it's gone a lot more about, you know, guiding them into the game as opposed to just kicking them, you know, through the door type deal.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I know, again, we have so many topics we could spend hours on, but I want to talk to you about a few recent trends in the game industry, and then we'll go back to talking about Luna for a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
And the two that I want to talk about first is, well, let's do, I guess, an easier one, would be the VR movement. Obviously, over the last few years, thanks to stuff like the Rift, and now we're seeing a lot of other devs get into it, VR is starting to make a comeback. And one of the popular elements of it is essentially bringing the player closer to that experience. I have a friend, Ken, who's on the cast regularly, and he talks about, you know, how mind-blowing it is to use the Rift to play games like Dear Esther, Gone Home, and whatever, compared to a traditional monitor. And there's a lot of debate as to whether or not Rift and VR technology is going to be the next big thing or just a general passing fad. So for you, Z, what do you think about that in terms of like VR's accessibility or viability in the future?
I mean, I think the debate whether or not VR is going to be the quote-unquote next big thing, it's already kind of cliched at this point because it already is kind of a big thing.
Yeah.
It's we were one of the first backers of the Oculus Rift. I think we had one of the first few hundred headset that was developed. It was on Kickstarter at one point. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was nice. It was really good. I think when I pretty much everyone, I guess, who first puts on the Oculus Rift would say wow. Like, I mean, that's what I did. That's what I heard people did. So you put it on, you're like, wow, this is so different from anything that you'll ever see. And that's that. It's wow. It's great. It's like you've been washing your clothes all your life by hand, and now you have a washing machine. Wow, that's so nice. It's still being developed. Obviously, it's still gonna be higher and higher quality as time goes on. I mean, the Oculus Rift, it's still not released yet technically, even though everyone already has one. And it's just gonna keep on going like that. I think it's almost like League of Legends in that sense. You first have something, and then you keep on making it until it gets better and better and just never really ends. There's not going to be a final product ever. I mean, even if there is, there's just going to be an Oculus Rift 2 afterwards. So VR technology is going to be better and better over time. That's no doubt about that. There's always going to be need for VR technology in pretty much everything. I mean, having a VR headset with a controller in your hand or having a keyboard and mouse in front of you, it's going to be so much cheaper than a whole, setup to train someone to pilot an airplane, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's there's just going to be needs. I mean, we've talked to government officials in the past where they're trying to build in conjunction with Oculus Rift and, like, for example, the Leap Motion, how do you even call that? AR technology? And just combine everything together to make data visualization stuff to help the government, be able to do their own minority report thing. And, that kind of stuff is always going to be needed. So as long as there's a need for a service, that service will continue to develop. And VR is probably going to be here to stay regardless.
Cool. Yep. And again, I think a lot of it goes back to just how they're really approaching it with the Rift and how they're really trying to cultivate it. We talked earlier in the cast about the passion of game development and the passion of trying to make something make a quality product versus making a profitable one. And it seems like the Rift and those guys are really trying to make it. They're not trying to make something that they're just going to cut and run from. And I know there was some talk when they were acquired by Facebook, that they're just selling out and whatnot. But it sounds like they're trying to make this a product that anyone can buy or anyone can easily get access to. And they're trying to really build this as a new market for people.
Yeah, honestly, I'm glad you brought up the Facebook acquisition or the Oculus Rift acquisition by Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
This is a topic that I hear a lot of people talk about, and it's how it's like they're selling out and stuff like that. I remember when the deal first happened, all of my investment banking friends started emailing me and calling me. It's like, Z, you got to tell me more about this Oculus Rift thing. They just spent like $2 billion on this shit. What's going on? And so, like, okay. I'll tell you a little bit. And I brought them in to try it out and stuff. And I think the acquisition from Facebook is critical for Oculus Rift. It was absolutely critical. The Oculus Rift was a video game hardware. It's always been a video game hardware, and it's going to be super difficult for them to go beyond that, because anyone could just slap a Samsung phone onto a piece of cardboard and make it work, right? I mean, look at the Google Cardboard. That's exactly what it is. And so Oculus Rift had no chance, really, to be more important, more relevant in the world. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Oculus Rift hardware, if you look at VR hardware in general, you'll see a screen that's from a smartphone, right? Mm-hmm. And smartphone screens, although they're very high definition, they are very low in definition if you put it right in front of your eyes. Mm-hmm. And there's no need for Samsung, there's no need for Apple to ever develop anything more clear than what's already on the iPhone, what's already on the Android, because there's no need. Your eyes aren't going to see it. So without the support of another large corporation who actually has a benefit from developing these really HD screens, the Oculus Rift is never going to look as good as, you know, real world. Mm-hmm. However, now that Facebook has acquired it and is able to give it the financial backing that it needs to take that next step, that's when Oculus Rift is able to start opening up new doors and developing new business plans.
Yep, interesting. And again, it really goes back to having that backing to be able to do these types of things. And another part is really how the competition is growing for VR. We're seeing a lot of other developers get in either with new types of controls, new types of lenses or HD screens. And it's going to be very interesting to just see how all this really plays out over the next, I would say maybe next 5 years. Now the Rift, I'm sorry, I don't follow it too much, but have they actually announced a release date for like the retail version of it yet?
No, they have not.
Okay.
Yeah. People are always guessing, but no one's ever right.
Yeah. And again, that's something that I think a lot of people are really going to look forward to, that day when we actually get a retail Rift out on the market, just to see how it goes and what the outside market really thinks of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking about the Rift, that serves a great segue into the other topic that I want to touch on with you, Z, and that is crowdfunding. Crowdfunding is another thing that is very new to the industry. I know Kickstarter, I believe, started in 2009, 2010, but the actual model didn't really take off until 2012 with the Double Fine Kickstarter. And that sort of just blew things way out of proportion. We saw so many developers turn to the model for funding, and that sort of led into the early access market. And even today, even though it's not as huge or not as exciting, we're still seeing it being very viable for game development and, more importantly, for public awareness of your game. So, for you, Z, as someone who started their studio over the last few years, what do you think about how crowdfunding has really grown over this short span of time?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you know this, but Luna's Wandering Stars was actually funded by Kickstarter.
Interesting.
No, yeah, so yeah, that was back in 2013, 2 years ago, when we ran that Kickstarter, I think October 2013. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that was interesting, I suppose, to say the least. Personally, this is speaking purely personally from my perspective. I'm not a fan of the crowdfunding stuff, especially not like, I'm okay as a payer. Like I really enjoy supporting other people, but I actually dislike having other people kind of like support the game, quote unquote, because essentially for me, it feels like I'm going around begging for money from all my friends and family, and then they're them spreading the word and stuff like that. It doesn't sit very well with me. But you know, going back to the topic of Kickstarter or crowdfunding as a whole, I know that recently there's a thing called the Square Enix Collective, which is actually, it's a Kickstarter for Kickstarter. So it's like, before you launch your Kickstarter campaign, you can launch a Square Enix Collective campaign and try to get people to pay for your Kickstarter before your Kickstarter even launches. And then that campaign would go on for a while. So it's like, yeah, you know, what is the world really coming to?
Yeah.
You know, go ahead.
I was just going to mention the Square Enix Collective. I think that's the thing where I spoke with Tanya from Kit Fox Games. Tanya Short, I think that was her name. She was talking about how they got on the Square Enix Collective for Shattered Planet. That's the name of the game.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's right now it's very crucial for you to be on Square Enix Collective. in order to have a successful Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, some of our close friends, developers, I won't say who they are. I know that, you know, we know people in the past that have launched the Kickstarter. It was vastly successful. Then they realize that they're bad at managing finances.
Mm-hmm.
So they blow all their money on stuff, and then they don't have the money to finish the game. Then they're like, oh, crap, now what? So they launch a second Kickstarter to try to fund the first game and the second game. And then they would run out of money for the second game, maybe mm-hmm. like didn't even finish the first. And then like this whole thing just kind of falls apart, right? I mean, why is it that whenever any person invests a large amount of money into a company, they have to look at their balance sheets, look at their income statements, right? You got to make sure that your investment is protected. However, Kickstarter doesn't have that. Crowdfunding doesn't have that protection. And you run into problems like, I remember a couple months ago, there was a game where it was vastly successful on Kickstarter, and then it just completely shut down. I don't remember what it was, and it caused a huge scene in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, go ahead.
I was trying to think of it off the top of my head. Was it that sword game or?
Yeah, I think yes, it was something like that. I can't remember the name. But you know, that's a problem. It causes people to lose faith in the system, right? How many more games like that do we need until the entire system collapses, right?
Yeah.
Or if we don't want the thing to collapse, then we're gonna have to set up some rules and regulations to keep it going. Mm-hmm. And which one is really ultimately better for production and for value for the gamers? that's always you know, different debates that we can go into, but that's my general thought.
Yeah, and you brought up two really good points about it. The first one I want to talk about is how your overall thoughts on the Kickstarter model, because that is very interesting, because I've heard from multiple developers who've had different thoughts about it. There are people who feel that it is an amazing thing, they love doing it, they want, you know, turn every game they make into a Kickstarter. But then there are people who are more reserved about it. As you said, it can be really weird getting your game funded by your fans before it's even, you know, out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And about that whole, you know, begging for money type thing, I feel the same way. I mean, I'm trying to do a Patreon campaign for Game Wisdom in order to get support. But it is just very weird asking people for money like that. But at the same time, I'm also trying to support the site and support my family.
Right,
so
right.
You're kind of trying to juggle these two differing thoughts in your head.
Yeah, I mean, from the economist perspective, if people are willing to pay you, that means there's a demand for what you do, right? So technically, the invisible hand is supposed to guide you in the right direction. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. I mean, you know, not to sound weird, but we're actually planning to launch a Kickstarter for our the King's Bird, our newest game, possibly later this year once we have more stuff to show. Because we believe that this game would, you know, it would perform very well on Kickstarter. It's exactly fitting to the needs of Kickstarter audiences, and it would really, you know, make that game a reality for us. Something that we truly believe in. If we were to get that Kickstarter support, so you know, there are definitely values to that, and I think it's important to, you know, to think on multiple sides of the spectrum.
Yeah. And the other point that I want to touch on that you mentioned, Z, is about a lot of people who do fail, even though they do a successful Kickstarter. And as you said, a lot of people have trouble managing that money, managing the costs and demands that go in Kickstarter. When I spoke with Anthony Conta last year, who does pen and paper and physical type board games, he talked about how one of the biggest things he saw people fail on is that they under prepare for the physical side of the reward system. It's why a lot of people don't like to do physical rewards due to the cost of shipping and managing that. And that can eat into your development. But on the flip side, I spoke with Greg Johnson from Human Nature, who ran the Toe Jam and Earl Kickstarter, and they had, you know, tons of physical goods. And he said, yeah, we know about the risk, but we spent the time, we went to multiple distributors and manufacturers to plan that out. And there, as he said, as you were saying, Z, there's a big difference between someone who just gets some money and then has no idea what to do with it, and someone who plans, you know, every detail of their Kickstarter and post-Kickstarter out to make sure that they have the funding needed to make what they want.
Yeah, I mean, physical rewards are expensive, and people pay a lot of money for the physical rewards sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times people forget that sometimes people who back your Kickstarter, they're already buying your game even though it's not out yet. It's almost like a pre-order.
Yeah.
right? And essentially, that's what it kind of turned into. I mean, people back Kickstarters. If they really believe in the vision, yeah, they'll back a lot of money for, you know, not much in return. They don't really care because they really believe the vision. Mm-hmm. But I think majority of the Kickstarter users, they want to get exclusive content. For example, you know, being able to play the beta, being able to, you know, have a t-shirt, exclusive Kickstarter backer only t-shirt that no one else would ever have. They would look at a game and be like, oh, this game is going to be humongous someday. I'm going to enjoy playing it, but, you know, it's going to be huge in the industry. I want to have this really cool t-shirt. I want to have this really cool keychain that no one else is going to have because I'm an early adopter, right? Mm-hmm. I think those are the things that Kickstarter kind of caters to. They're not there to pay for you to finish the game. They're there to get content from you. They're paying for content from the developers. And developers kind of, I think a lot of people kind of forget that. And they feel like, oh, these people are just going to pay us money and then we'll finish the game. Then we'll sell the game. Then we make more money and everything will be fine. And it's not that simple.
Yep, definitely. And again, we could spend like the next 30 minutes or so talking more about Kickstarter. But I don't want to keep you too long. So to wrap up about Kickstarter, then, I have one question for you. And this one I like to ask a lot of the developers. As you said, you've experienced Kickstarter with Luna. You're going to be doing it with your upcoming game. So in terms of Kickstarter as a platform, what are your thoughts on whether or not it is a sustainable model for the future? This is another topic that we hear all sorts of things from various developers. I'm just curious about what your thoughts on it, Z.
Yeah, I think there are three outcomes for Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Number one, it could just be a fad and it could die out. I mean, after a few years, people are like, oh, Kickstarter, oh, whatever, I don't really care. And then people just don't visit the site anymore. People don't care about the word anymore. It's not buzz anymore. And it'll just be forgotten, kind of like MySpace, I guess. Mm-hmm. And another scenario would be, you know, it continues being big, it continues being important, it continues being relevant in not only video games, but the entire startup industry, then it's going to start to break. And people are going to start abusing the system. I came across a company this one time, it's a startup company. They only do Kickstarters. They literally only do, like, they would start a company, do a Kickstarter for a product, take the money, go quote-unquote bankrupt, keep the money, then they use that money to do a second Kickstarter, and they would just keep on doing that. I mean, how long would it take until these people break the system, right? People are going to be like, oh, I can't trust Kickstarter anymore. I lost that trust. If I put the money in here, I'm not going to get anything, so what's the point? Mm-hmm. That's where Kickstarter is going to fail as well. And the third scenario would probably be something where regulations are going to be put into place. I mean, the Kickstarter developers might put in some regulations. Then other crowdfunding sources will probably start making other things. It's possible that we're going to have multiple different crowdfunding platforms and that are equally as big, not just one dominating the whole industry. And perhaps, you know, government or, you know, the Fed or something like that could step in and be like, this is not okay. You can't just have all, you know, unconfirmed backings of investment without any information to the operations or something like that. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden that would change the whole landscape as well. So I don't know. From my perspective, those are probably the three most likely outcomes.
Yep. Interesting. Again, it's something that, like VR, we're just going to have to wait and see how the market actually develops it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I think with that, we can start to move into our final topic then for this cast. And again, Z, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And hopefully we can have you back on with future casts because we have so many more topics we can talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's great to talk to you too. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right, so with that, the final topic then is I want to return to Luna's Wandering Stars, because at the time of this recording, the game is due out in a few weeks, and this podcast should be out just as the game is released. So for people listening, could you tell us a little bit about what Luna's Wandering Stars is?
Absolutely. Luna's Wandering Stars originated as an idea of, hey, why don't we make a game that is equally as addicting as games like Angry Birds and, you know, all the other puzzle games that you play on your phone and on your computer, mm-hmm. but add more value to it. Make it so that when you're playing the game, you're learning, you're growing, you're expanding your own knowledge base. So what we did is we made Luna's Wandering Stars. It's a planetary physics puzzle game. So the game features 100% real physics in a very addicting kind of gameplay. Mm-hmm. The game kind of goes through nine different planets or eight different planets and Pluto. We count Pluto as a planet. And each planet would have its 15 different levels to solve their individual puzzles. And each planet features a completely different power. So, for example, when you start the game, you're going to play all the Mercury levels. And Mercury, you're playing around with velocity. You're trying to build an orbit for your moon around the planet in order to, you know, collect asteroids around the planet. And then, you know, when you get into later parts of the game, you start exploring things like force, gravity, black holes. You're doing trigonometry, you're doing geometry, you're doing planetary physics. You're essentially, you're learning to become a rocket scientist without realizing it. That's the goal of the game. And, you know, the game's gotten quite a bit of recognition. We showed the game to Bill Nye, the science guy. We showed the game to Buzz Aldrin, you know, at different events. You know, they really liked it. They really, I think it's a good idea to have, you know, the Angry Birds type of addicting gameplay, and still have the educational, you know, aspect of it. So when you're playing, you're secretly learning. Mm. We've talked to a lot of educators where, you know, they're actually putting this game into the classroom setting for middle school and high schoolers so that they're used to physics before they're even taking their first physics classes.
Very interesting. I just had a podcast with Zach Barth from Zachtronics where we talked about the educational side of games and making education games or those that can be used in the classroom. And we talked about a lot of the challenges and unique considerations with that. And he said with a lot of his games, like Space Chem and Infinite Factory, how it is about, you know, delivering a puzzle or an experience, but then there's the underlying layers of the education aspect. With Space Chem, it was about programming. Infinite Factory, it's more about like assembly line or engineering type design.
Yeah, it's really funny you mentioned that. Space Chem is actually one of our major inspirations when we first designed this game. So, because we saw Space Chem and we're like, this is a really good idea. You can learn a lot from playing something like this. I mean, it's not real chemistry by no means. Are you a chemist by the end of it? But you learn a lot about logic, about, you know, reasoning and stuff like that. And we felt like, hey, why not do something physics related with rocket science, you know? So that's how this game came to be.
Interesting. I should definitely try to get you and Zach on cast. So I'm sure you two would just love talking to each other.
That would be amazing, yeah.
All right, so with the game, as you said, it's about the physics of these different planets and developing the puzzle around them. In terms of like the actual like puzzle, or in terms of what the player is doing, what is like the objective, or how are the puzzles meant to be solved?
The puzzles are pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. You control moons around the planet through various different ways. Mm-hmm. And your goal is to collect asteroids around the moons or around the planets in order to grow in size and grow in mass. And once you reach a certain amount of mass, you beat the level, and then you continue on. So, you know, as you're playing games like that, you'll realize that the more mass that you have, the heavier you are, the stronger the gravitational pull is, mm-hmm. which changes your velocity, changes your speed, changes your force. So everything's a little different. As you collect more asteroids, and it's a little bit harder to balance, you know, things like that.
Interesting. And it's based on, you're just basing on 8, or I guess if we want to count Pluto, the 9 planets of the solar system, right?
Yep, for now. And we are already developing challenge levels and, you know, additional content to patch it in for DLC, or DLC, probably free DLCs after the game gets released. We just can't finish them by the release date, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And also, the game features a level editor and online sharing. Mm-hmm. So anyone can pick up the game, make their own levels, and share them online. I mean, teachers could use this game and simulate some kind of a physics question for an exam and tell students to try to solve it through their physics knowledge if they wanted to, because it's all 100% real physics.
That is actually a really great point you just brought up, Z, about level editors and custom mods that could be used for these types of games from an educational slant. Because at that point, you could really have your cake and eat it too. You could have this game that's, you know, meant for either casual or core gamers, but then you could have someone like a teacher who really loves it. They could design class-specific levels that can teach students about these various elements. And with the joy of, or the ease of, like, Steam Workshop support and just the modding in general, it's becoming a lot easier to share this custom content. And that's another great thing about Steam. Like, you could have Steam in a classroom and say, okay, just create this level, and within minutes, it can be uploaded to all your students' files or have that information then sent back to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a really great point. I think if we do have another cast regarding educational games, I think talking about workshop or having the teacher essentially create their own content, I think that's a really good topic to bring up.
Yeah, it's like Minecraft, right?
Yeah.
It's huge because of it.
Definitely. Now, in terms of the game itself, You said you have the challenge levels, which will come after launch. Are there any, like, reasons to replay levels, like high score capacity or medals or, you know, a lot of stuff we see? Or even stuff like the, oh, I forget the name off the top of my head from, like, Space Chem, how it grades your score compared to...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. You played Mario Galaxy, right? And you know how you collect stars and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's this game is pretty similar. Each level has three different golden asteroids.
Mm-hmm.
You can beat the level by collecting normal asteroids and not collecting any gold at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy usually to create one gold. To collect one golden asteroid and to beat the level. But it's usually extremely difficult to collect three golden asteroids per level. And that's how you truly, complete a game. You know, to beat the game from beginning to end, just beating every single level, it would take about maybe 5-6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you want to really be hardcore about it, if you want to collect every single golden asteroid in the game, it'll probably take, 30-40 hours. I personally, I never got there because it was some of the levels were so difficult and it's hard to keep track of all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So for the hardcore, there's definitely a lot of end game that you can do.
Cool. All right. So for pricing, Luna, what kind of pricing are you aiming for with the Steam release?
We're actually still a little bit talking about it right now.
Okay.
We're probably going to land at the $9.95 mark or $9.99 mark. So $10 essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because we feel like it's our first title on Steam. We want to make it a little bit more accessible for the players.
Mm-hmm.
Try to build the name a little bit. Especially with an educational title like this, we want to spread it out to the world. We want to make it a little bit, lower cost so more people can play it. I mean, I think we could easily price it at something like $15 or $20,
mm-hmm.
but we don't have that need, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Besides Steam, are you aiming for any other platforms like GOG or even on the mobile store?
Yeah, the game will be on pretty much every PC distributor out there. I mean, GOG is one, Green Man Gaming, and
mm-hmm.
all that other stuff. We're actually thinking about porting the game to the Wii U and mobile devices as well, just
mm-hmm.
because this game works so well on a touchscreen. We're going to see how that works. We built the game in Unity, and some of the Unity porting stuff gets a little wonky depending on which platforms you're trying to port it to.
Yeah, definitely. All right. I think with that, I'm just about out of questions. I don't want to keep you any longer. Are there any parts about Luna that I didn't mention that you would like to bring up or tell the audience about?
I mean, nothing really comes to mind. I mean, it's one of our first titles, and we really want to bring this, educational and fun and addicting experience to the game industry. And, hopefully we'll see some response, from all the gamers.
Awesome. All right, Z. It has been a fantastic conversation. I know we were only supposed to talk for an hour, but as I said before the cast, we started talking about a lot of great topics. Things
yeah.
can quickly balloon.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
yeah,
go ahead.
I mean, likewise, I really enjoyed speaking on here. I didn't realize how fun it would be. Completely lost track of time here, too.
Yeah.
It's, thank you so much for inviting me over.
Yeah, not a problem. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Z. And again, it's been such a fascinating conversation. I would love to have you back on, hopefully within the next few weeks after the game's release, and just for like some general podcast or game industry related topics.
Yeah, absolutely. That would work great for me. I mean, I love talking. I guess I love listening to the voice of my own voice, right? But that's no problem for me. I would love to be part of anything here.
Awesome. All right, with that, my final question then for you, Z, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to the fans listening?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I guess this is more of a comment for, what you're doing. I think what you're doing is fantastic. You know, having sitting down and talking to some of the developers behind some of these games, especially the smaller titles like us,
mm-hmm.
it generates a lot of conversation. It generates a lot of flow of how the industry is going. The questions that you asked me were phenomenal in terms of just really challenging how the industry is moving forward, covering a lot of key topics. I think thank you so much for running a service, running a website like this that's able to get really high quality content out there from some of the people that are less heard out there in the world.
Yeah, thank you. Definitely spread the word because we're always looking for more people to come on and just more topics to talk about.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So with that, we're going to wrap things up for right now. Z, again, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I wish you the best of luck with Luna, which for those of you listening, it should either be out or coming out really soon when this podcast goes up.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yep, not a problem. So, for those of you listening, we're going to end things here for the Perceptive Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. And as always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. First, for guest pieces or being a future podcast guest, you can find all the information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. For our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed funding to help keep things running, help pay those annoying bills, you can find all that information under the Patreon banner, also on the front page. And last but not least, if you would like to watch me play games live and talk about their design, I play games frequently on Twitch. You can find me under GW Bicer, and that gets uploaded to the Game Wisdom YouTube page as well after the recording. So make sure to check that out. And with that, I will be saying goodbye here for tonight. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.